Case number 21-5927, Donna Sherwood versus Tennessee Valley Authority. Oral arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Val, you may proceed for the appellants.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. My name is Don Vowell for the appellants, the plaintiffs, and I do request 3 minutes of rebuttal.
Certainly.
And I would like to talk about four main things. One, whether TVA has satisfied the terms of the injunction. And second, does the injunction merely require TVA to make an effort to comply with NEPA? And third, is this really a new alternative, or is it the functional equivalent of the 15-foot rule? And then for the precedent or rationale for reviewing the EIS environmental impact statement in the present lawsuit. So the first topic, whether TVA has satisfied the terms of the injunction, the question is whether we really have the completion of the procedural steps necessary to comply with NEPA. That's the wording of the injunction.
So, Mr. Val, would it be your position that in order to comply with the terms of the or meet the terms of the injunction for dissolution, the TVA must, in fact, comply with NEPA?
Exactly. Exactly. And okay. And I think that support the that's what the injunction says, quoting the completion of the procedural steps necessary to comply with NEPA. Mm-hmm. And the second point that I was, so obviously we don't think they have done that. And certainly the court has not, the court said, well, I'm not going to decide that today. I'm going to, somebody else can decide that. And
did the court expressly say that?
I think so.
In its order, did it say that?
I think it said that if I'm following the question correctly, and I can't quote, you know, what I'm thinking, but it was clear at least that the court was not deciding whether this the EIS was a hard look, that it did comply with NEPA. It said that this would, you know, better decided by some other court. Now that's my recollection.
It seemed to me, and I'm willing to be corrected on anything I say in this argument, but it seemed to me that we remanded the case last time precisely for compliance with NEPA, and that compliance with NEPA would seem to be the touchstone for releasing the agency to execute the 15-foot rule, as opposed to compliance with the district court's injunction, which is itself only derivative of the mandate from our court, so to speak, to comply with NEPA and proceedings consistent with this opinion. So it would seem, I guess I'm just saying, it seems to me that compliance with NEPA really is the touchstone here.
Yeah, I think so.
And I could be wrong. I want to hear both sides.
I think that's what this court intended and said, and I think that's what the injunction said. You know, that's exactly what it said. And the court said that it was, you know, TVA has made an effort to comply with NEPA. And of course, I don't think that, that is not enough to comply with NEPA. And, you know, the injunction says what it says, the completion of the procedural steps necessary to comply with NEPA. So, of course, to comply with NEPA, you have to take a hard look at the environmental consequences.
Counsel, so, shouldn't we, though, what concerns me about that approach is that it suggests that Judge Farland misunderstood what he was ordering.
I don't know. The TVA says, oh, he's in the best position to interpret.
Well, isn't he? I mean, I had the same reaction. I mean, you would think that if he was maybe speaking a little loosely, but saying, I just want to make sure they go through the procedural aspect of compliance as opposed to the hard look substantive or quasi-substantive review. That's what I want to make sure of. And then if they've done that, then we proceed from there. That's what it's, and that's how he seemed to interpret it.
He did. He did. But the thing is, the environmental impact statement is a procedural step. It's the key.
I understand that argument, but it apparently in the district court's mind, there's procedure in general, and then there's procedure that he's requiring. Okay. But that's all. I mean, that doesn't mean it's wrong. It's just the words get confusing. I mean, sure, it's part of the procedure, but you got to admit that, you know, whether you had a hearing is more procedural than whether you took a good enough look at something. In some sense.
Well, I certainly, you know, I get what you're saying. But this is put into our brief, the procedural part of NEPA is there's a substantive part and a procedural part. This is the procedural part. You know, the court cannot order TVA to make any particular decision. All they can do is, you know, the TVA has to comply with the procedural steps, which are, you know, the environmental impact statement. So
real difference does it make to you if the court in this case does the hard look review or reviews for whether there was an adequate hard look, or a court in a case that where the complaint starts right off looking at alternative C?
There are two or three or more things that and I think that's a very good question. And the one I've thought of, the first problem is they say they're going to do site-specific reviews, one for each transmission line segment. So if it goes to other lawsuit, it's not just one lawsuit. This thing is going to spawn into multiple lawsuits, and I don't know how many. And that leads us to the case of Sierra Club versus Penfold, which is one that the court cited.
If we were to go along with this reasoning, couldn't we just say that we understand this to mean that a new suit would be brought that would be able to challenge the, what do you call it? PEIS, P is for programmatic.
Yes.
But they could challenge that. They don't have to wait for each individual one in order to challenge the programmatic one.
In other words,
to challenge the adoption of alternative C.
Yeah, so that would be better than having lawsuits all over the seven states.
Well, region. I mean, you'd still be able to bring your separate lawsuit, I suppose. But if you want to challenge the adoption of alternative C, presumably you could do that, seek an injunction against the enforcement of alternative C.
Yeah, and that would be the kind of the second problem. We'd have to go through the whole injunction, you know, process, and so that would be a drawback to doing it that way. But what's the drawback?
What's the drawback?
Well, the fact that we'd have to go through and start over with an injunction, you know, and maybe it would be.
Well, I mean, if we send this back, you're still going to have to modify your pleadings to deal with alternative C. I'm not seeing that it's great. What else is there that's a problem?
Well, the other thing, what I've seen in the cases, and this is the case that one of the cases the court cited, when you have a project that is already well in progress, like this one that we have here, you naturally have a concern about the predetermined result. This is like the Montana wilderness case that the court talked about. You know, they had
counsel. I don't want to cut. I want to hear that argument, I guess, but I want to identify at the beginning that the argument would apply whether arbitrary and capricious review is applied to the adoption of alternative C in this case or in another case. You'd still be making the same argument, wouldn't you?
I suppose we would, but.
So it doesn't really tell me why we should choose between. It seems to me like the two big options here are have this case reviewed in a separate suit, which addresses directly ab initio alternative C, or whether it's something that we should tell the district court to go ahead and do in the context of this case.
Yeah.
And then I was asking you, why, what difference does it make? So if you make one of the arguments you're going to make in both cases, it doesn't tell me which of those two is a better approach. Are you with me?
How are you prejudiced by filing another lawsuit?
I think this court, the present court, is much better situated to make the decision. You know, we've already been through everything. You know, we have a history of, you know.
Go ahead, Judge Rogers.
Please go ahead, Judge Molloy.
Do you think that the terms of the injunction contemplated a ultimate review by Judge Garland on the merits of the EIS?
I think so, because I'm looking right at it, and it said after completion of the procedural steps necessary to comply with NEPA. I mean, the injunction, very plain words, that is what it says. So, you know, just this idea that, oh, they've filed something, it's kind of an effort that satisfies. I don't really you know, obviously agree with that. And
no, I understand.
We also have these unresolved questions of contempt of court and, you know, the history of violating NEPA and, you know, this idea that concern that it's intentional. Those are all things that are, I think, much better dealt with the present court.
The judgment entered in this court when?
The last one here?
Yes.
I think it was...
Well, whenever it was, the appeal from the judgment is long since expired, correct?
No. If you're about finality, is that the question of finality?
Well, the procedural history here is a judgment was entered along with the injunction, correct?
In the district court.
We're in the district court.
Yes, there was several orders entered, an injunction order, another order, and there have been several orders.
I think Judge Maloney's referring to the 2017 district court order, which purported to resolve everything and included an injunction, which was a conditional injunction that would go until something happened.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
That's kind of the final order of the case is what he's asking. Mm-hmm. I think.
Well,
that's exactly what I'm asking.
That happened in 2017, and then we had the TVA file the motion to dissolve the injunction. That order, of course, is more recent. That was just that's the order that was probably the final order in the case, and that's the order that we're here on today. Or that, of course, with it all relates back. Everything in the case, I think, is currently on appeal. The amendment to Rule 3.
That makes sense, but it isn't the way that the district court considered it. It looked like the district court thought that the 2017 order was a final order, but it had some elements of it that had to be dealt with when the injunction was complied with or not. And then he treated that under Rule 60B as if it was a post-judgment order.
Yeah, but it wasn't.
I'm just saying that's your conception is different from the district court's conception. Isn't that correct?
For the third time.
Yeah.
Okay. Any further questions before we hear from the other side?
Not for me.
All right. Very well. Mr. Valley, you'll have your rebuttal and we'll hear from the agency.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Regina Coho on behalf of the Appalachian Tennessee Valley Authority. This is a case in which, for lack of a better phrase, TVA messed up. And TVA acknowledged that fact following the second appeal in this case by confessing error in its failure to do an environmental review of the policy that the plaintiffs challenged in 2012. And by preparing an EIS to study several options for vegetation management on its transmission lines that took over 2 years to complete and cost almost $1.4 million. The injunction that resulted resulted in the plaintiffs receiving all of the relief that they asked for in their complaint, plus their vegetation management standards govern TVA's practices, As they requested, TVA was required to report throughout the injunctive period on its spending on vegetation management, and they received $600,000 in attorney's fees. The only thing that plaintiffs did not get in the injunction that they asked for was their request that the injunction remain in place until the district court reviewed the adequacy of the EIS. Yet now on appeal, the plaintiffs claim that it was an abuse of discretion for the district court not to do that. But based on this procedural history and the text of the injunction, plaintiff's position is utterly unsupported. And moreover, the district's court decision in this case comports with the basic rule in APA cases, which is that after a matter is sent back to the agency, the propriety of that decision is challenged in a new lawsuit. So we would ask that the district court's decision to dissolve the injunction be affirmed.
Well, and also, go ahead.
Someone, I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
Well, I mean, I guess I'll just reiterate what I said earlier, and I could be mistaken in my, understanding of the relevant facts here. It's been a while in this case, but I thought last time we remanded to the district court, basically with for the reason that the agency needed to conduct or do an EIS in compliance with NEPA, that had not been done yet. As to the 15-foot rule, because the agency had regarded it as maintenance, and we're saying no, it's not maintenance, and you have to do an EIS, and so we send it back to the district court for the agency to go ahead and do an EIS to comply with NEPA, and so you folks obviously put a lot of time into that, and you come up with a 328-page EIS, and so I guess isn't it true that the district court, in order to come sort of proceed consistent with our opinion and with the law, didn't the district court need to make a determination that the agency's EIS was in fact compliant with NEPA before the court could release the agency to go ahead and execute the rule?
Well, I'll be quite honest. I haven't looked back at the details of the second opinion that this court issued in detail recently.
The district court's injunction doesn't stand on its own bottom. It's the authority to enjoin the agency from doing something it had planned to do came from NEPA, it would seem. And you have to comply with this statute before you can go forward. And so I'm scratching my head about the focus on the district court's injunction as the lodestar here. I mean, why isn't compliance with NEPA requisite at the end of the day before you all can proceed with, the 15-foot rule? I could be wrong about something in all this, but that's kind of my sense right now.
I don't want to say definitively that this court's opinion required, I think we could have gone back down and continued to argue that the 15-foot rule had no continuing effect, and we could have done a trial, and had discovery and things of that nature. So I think that there was, I did not read the opinion to definitively
you stipulated basically that you were, that it would violate NEPA, or that you had not complied with NEPA and that you needed to comply with NEPA. I mean, I think that's,
yes.
I mean, forget about our court. I mean, you kind of came to a meeting of the minds that we need to comply with NEPA and we need to do an EIS as to the 15-foot rule before we start cutting. And why isn't that true now? And why didn't that require the district court to make a determination, not only that you tried, but that you succeeded to comply with NEPA?
Well, I think it hinges on, partly on the determination that this wasn't the 15-foot rule that was challenged in 2012.
Let's say we disagree with that point.
I think if you disagree with that point, I mean, there's still nothing, the district court cited multiple cases in which district courts had gone either way, had kept jurisdiction to review an EIS and had not. And I don't think that there was anything that definitively required the district court to keep jurisdiction to review the EIS. And quite frankly, I mean, I think, you know, the district court didn't do a robust look at the EIS, but it did look at the EIS in addressing, albeit briefly, some of the plaintiff's arguments. I think it's on
yes, he did.
On page ID, this is the amended opinion, docket entry 479 at page ID 29191. You know, the district court goes through and says, well, the plaintiffs have said there's not the analysis that needs to be here, but I'm looking through here and I see that there's the discussion of soil effects, soil erosion effects, the impact of the policy on wildlife, federal and state laws on the protection of migratory birds. Maybe it's not in the exact, it's not analyzed in the exact way that the plaintiffs want it to be, but that's not the question under
here. Counsel, that suggests what your answer will be to the question I really want to ask you, which is whether you agree that plaintiffs are entitled to review of the adoption of alternative C under hard look review based on the administrative record.
Are you asking if they're entitled to bring a new lawsuit? The answer
I assume that you think it should be brought in a new lawsuit, but are you agreeing that either brought in a new lawsuit or in this lawsuit, one of them, they get it? And that it's not, because I took that to be the thrust of your brief, although it's a little bit inconsistent with this part of the opinion that you're relying on now, which makes me wonder, are you saying that this is adequate review even without the administrative record of alternative C, and that we have to now evaluate these arguments that the district court hardly got into, or should we read the district court as permitting and indeed contemplating that a new lawsuit would be brought where alternative C would be reviewed in light of the administrative record on a fuller basis? Which way are you arguing?
In all frankness, I think there's a bit of inconsistency within the district court's opinion. I mean, I don't think that is a fulsome, adequate review. I think that the alternative that was chosen in the EIS is more appropriately challenged in a new lawsuit with the administrative record in front.
All right, I understand that, but you do at least agree that it would be reasonable to conclude that they're entitled to it one place or the other. And I'm going to ask you the same question I asked opposing counsel. Why is it better to do it in a new lawsuit than it is to do it in this lawsuit? I mean, does it come down to whether alternative C is all that different from the 15-foot rule, or is there something else?
I think it does come down to the fact that this is a new alternative. We're talking about clearing vegetation, clearing trees. So there's going to be some similarities amongst any.
Talking mainly about trees. I mean, it's 15-foot trees, right? Not 15-foot rose bushes.
Well, I think it would apply to any sort of vegetation. I think that the 15-foot rule applied to any sort of vegetation.
What they were challenging was not being able to have trees in the buffer zones.
Well, and also in the wire zones, because there were two components they were actually two separate things within TVA. There was the buffer zone issue, and then there was the 15-foot rule was really applied to yard trees or things in the wire zone, trees on in people's yards. And so
But the allegations were that trees were just mowed down because they were trees.
Right.
Right. So I'm just trying to get at first, whether the answer to my earlier question largely logically turns on how different alternative C is to the 15-foot rule. And the district court, the thrust of its opinion, the core of it appears to be that these are two different things and they ought to be in two different lawsuits. My first question is why does it make such a big difference? But the second and right now more pertinent question to me is I think, yeah, it makes sense for us to, for the district judge to do it in two different lawsuits if they came to two different conclusions. But the core of the suit was banning the planting of trees, and your opposing counsel in his brief and in his reply brief repeatedly says that the appendix, which lists the kinds of growth that would be allowed, include nothing that anybody would call a tree. And you just don't respond to that. And it seems like it might ultimately, or at least logically, be determinative, because it'll tell us whether alternative C is just a gussied up 15-foot rule or whether it is different.
Well,
are you with me? Do you see what I'm asking?
I do see what you're asking. I understand. So let me address the appendix first. That's a comprehensive list. It's not an exclusive list. And there's nothing in the EIS that states that that the property that is primarily maintained by others, that people can only have the vegetation that's on this appendix. And the reason for this is kind of the appendix.
It reads that way, though. I mean, it doesn't seem to say that.
Well, I mean, why would there be a reason for TVA to specify that on residential lands, orchards, forest plantations, agricultural lands, or other similar areas, they're going to work with landowners on a case-by-case basis?
That's a good question, because whatever that language is that incorporates Appendix H, whichever, what is the language that incorporates it or refers to it, sounds like that's what you got to have. Can you find that? I can't find that for me. The language that...
There's nothing that says that that's all that you have to have, that you cannot plan.
What does it say? How does it read is what I'm asking. It sounds like it does when I read it, but I don't have it in front of me.
I mean, I think you have to look at... So here's an example in the EIS. This is in the summary at 25. It says... with local property owners to evaluate compatibility of vegetation within or near the transmission row. Vegetation compatible with the safe and reliable operation of the transmission system may be allowed to remain within the row. It doesn't say that vegetation that is contained on Appendix H and Appendix H will be allowed to remain. And this frankly isn't borne out in the EIS, and it's not in the record, but I can represent to the court that the right-of-way organization does not understand Appendix H to be an exclusive list. And in fact, they're making a concerted effort to work with landowners to allow other types of trees that are not listed on this appendix to remain on property if they are compatible, if they will not, pose a risk to the reliability of the transmission line.
If we were to agree with you and have this case and affirm on the theory that that plaintiffs can bring another suit and to establish that trees and where you would be able to argue in response that trees are allowed, even though it seems not to say that, but parts of it do say it, but parts of it when you get to the actual details of the operative language, it seems not to say that. You could work all of that out. To what extent would you argue things like res judicata, and that was decided before? I mean, imagine that's what one reason that starting a new lawsuit might be something that plaintiffs would be concerned about.
Personally, I assume I would be dealing with the lawsuit. That's not an argument that I would anticipate making. I think that TVA is very interested, if a new lawsuit is brought, in defending this study on the merits, and okay, we believe will be successful.
And what is the real, finally, maybe I'm repeating myself, what's the harm in doing it in the context of this case as opposed to the other case? Because they're saying they don't have to go through a motion for an injunction because there's an injunction in place. Why should they have to go through and litigate another new injunction if we get to litigate this anyway in the district court?
Well, because from TVA's perspective, this is a different policy, and they should have to be able to establish a likelihood of success on the merits as to this study. And so You know, that's just a procedural hoop that litigants have to jump through, and they haven't articulated any reason that they shouldn't have to do that, other than it would be, you know, additional work or difficult for them. So,
counsel, do you contemplate any bar from plaintiff to file that second lawsuit challenging the EIS? What's TVA's position on that?
You know, I can't, you know, say for sure, you know, at this point, or represent, you know, what we might argue. I mean, I do think that the plaintiffs will have to establish standing. I mean, obviously the standing rules are more relaxed.
Assume they have established standing.
Mm-hmm.
Then I mean, you're speaking for the agency. You know the case. It's right here in front of us. What's the answer to Judge Maloney's question?
If they have standing, then we're going to be litigating.
Well, if I appreciate TVA's position on this appeal, TVA is taking the position the plaintiffs have got to file another lawsuit, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so are you or are you not taking the position with this court that plaintiffs can file that lawsuit without any sort of bar from TVA on a procedural or legal ground, and that plaintiff in the new lawsuit would have the ability to get to the merits of the EIS?
Yes, that's what we're saying. I mean, we're not going to argue that, you know, the minimal look that was taken in the district court opinion is somehow going to bar you know, substantive review in a new lawsuit. No, we think it's obviously appropriate for this to be challenged.
That's helpful.
Okay.
Apart from that, is there any practical reason, apart from the technical reason, why we couldn't just leave it in the same lawsuit?
You're
going to have to litigate it anyway. Just send it back and say, do that kind of thing in this lawsuit.
Yeah, I don't know that there's, I mean, I think it's more of a technical thing rather than a practical thing.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Very well.
No, thank you, Judge.
Appreciate your answers, Ms. Coho, and we'll hear from Mr. Vowell.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two or three things. I have here page 73 of the environmental impact statement, which I think is the question, the section that you were asking about a while ago. And it's kind of the trigger. It connects to the appendix or the appendix H. And it says, under this alternative, and I think I snipped this into the brief, under this alternative, TVA would have the option to allow compatible trees to remain in areas actively maintained by others, such as residential lands, orchards, and whatnot. And then it says compatible tree species of trees are listed in Appendix H. And then if you look at Appendix H, the cover page of Appendix H says compatible species list. But if you look at the top of the list, it says comprehensive list. Now, during the argument, I got out my dictionary. I was pretty sure I knew what comprehensive meant, but when counsel started talking about it, I wasn't so sure. It says covering completely. So, you know, this is the complete list of trees that are allowed. And that dictionary is like 50 years old, but it's a good one. Now, so that is, you know.
Okay.
That's pretty much it. And so it's the very same thing, isn't it? It's the 15-foot rule by, you know, another name. So I think that's pretty much it.
All right. Is that your rebuttal or do you have more?
A
minute and 15 seconds.
Well, you know, the wording of the order, and this gets back to the injunction, I think the more important question is what did this court intend? And, you know, the bottom line is they have to comply with NEPA.
Now, when you say that, I mean, I guess I should be more clear. I mean, At least when I was saying that, I was thinking of the procedural aspects of NEPA as opposed to surviving hard look, I guess. What do you mean?
I mean surviving hard look.
Okay.
Well, I've, I've spent some time looking at, I don't claim expertise on any of this, but the hard look is a procedural step.
Yeah, I understand. It's sort
I know you all get that, but
almost a hybrid. Yeah,
and the court very plainly said that the court will retain jurisdiction over the injunction beyond defendant's representation that it has issued an EIS. And I think the court, these words say what they simply mean what they say.
Are you challenging the sufficiency of the EIS apart from the hard look issue?
No, I don't think so. I don't know. Okay. Maybe I don't understand the question, but no, I don't think so.
Okay. I mean, it's an adequate sort of, assessment of the things that NEPA requires them to assess apart from hard look.
Well, it was, I guess, done in the right, they did it with the right time. They gave public options to look at it and those things, of course.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Very well. Any questions further?
No,
we thank you both for your argument and for your briefing, and the case will be submitted.